You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on.
Well, good morning, garden folks, flower fanciers and plant lovers. You have tuned in to the 3CR Gardening Show. Happy Sunday to those of you tuning in live and a big hello, of course, to those who tune in via the podcast. My name's Chloe Thompson, and in the studio with me today, we have three wonderful guests, two regulars and one newbie, which I'm very excited about. So let's start with the newbie first, shall we? Buttons okay. Mirror, welcome to the studio. Buttons is a mushroom farmer and the author of a brand new book, Mushroomery. So welcome, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
A pleasure. We're going to chat mushrooms and we're going to chat your book soon. So let's welcome the other two who we've got here. We've got Ben Brooker from Antique Perennials, if I can speak.
No, Treasure Perennials.
Treasures Perennials. Why am I saying Antique?
It's
Treasure
very similar.
Perennials. It is similar, isn't it?
Yeah.
See, I haven't had a second coffee. That's my problem.
Okay, good morning.
Good morning. And you have an incredible array of little plants in front of you. As usual, one or two I recognise and one or two I have no idea about. So
yeah, some pretty nice ones in there.
So, yeah. So we'll chat definitely more about those as well. And the third voice in the studio and person here, you're probably used to sitting in my seat over here in the host seat.
It's nice being over this side of the jump. All care, no responsibility. Oh, no, did I say that?
Oh, who said that out loud? John Arnott, horticulturist and regular co-host here on 3CR. So welcome to everybody.
Hey, Chloe, how you doing?
Good, good. Did you all fight some fog? It was thick pea soup from me.
Sure was, down
there. Very foggy in Reservoir.
Yeah, really weird. Normally I find that it lifts as I get closer to the city, but no, it just kept going.
Yeah. Well, I came in from Bayside, Melbourne, and visibility was down to maybe 100 metres or something like that. It was really thick.
It was really thick, wasn't it? Now, hey, we should tell everyone who is listening from the very get-go, just a heads up, that today's show will only be running until 9 a.m. rather than 9:15, just because the show that goes on after us has a special episode. So we're shifting things forward to accommodate that. So just a heads up, we will be wrapping things up at just before 9 o'clock.
An abbreviated show that goes for an hour and a half.
Yeah, exactly. You poor things.
It is long form radio, isn't it?
It is long form radio.
It just means one less plant to talk about. Yeah. So that's it. So, no,
well, you've got a fair few there. So maybe we should start you off early enough. So for those of you who don't know me, my name's Chloe Thompson, as I said. I'm the editor of ABC Organic Gardener magazine. I'm also a horticulturist and passionate gardener as well. But Mira, let's have a bit of a chat about your book, can we?
Yeah, sure.
So I got to review and read your book for the mag. I think it's actually in the current issue that I'm holding here. And it's an absolutely gorgeous book all about how to grow mushrooms for home gardeners. Mm-hmm. You know, is it something you've wanted to do for a while?
The book?
Yeah.
So not really.
Yeah.
I was very lucky. I just got emailed by Smith Street Books and they were like, do you want to write a book? And I was like, okay, sure. So, yeah. Here we are.
That's impressive. But they clearly saw you as like, you know, a fountain of knowledge on mushrooms. Because how long have you been mushroom farming?
I've been farming mushrooms for more than 8 years now.
Okay. Yep.
So, yeah, I just started in my backyard and things escalated. Yeah.
So tell us about your current mushroom farm. Where is it and like what does it do?
Oh, yeah. So my farm at the moment's based in Elphington. So super urban, super close to the city. It's called The Mushroomery, just the same as the title of the book, The Mushroomery. And I've got 5 shipping containers there that we grow in. We supply like local farmers markets, cafes, restaurants, box schemes. And I teach as well.
Yeah, because you're heading off after this to teach a workshop.
Yeah, so I'm going to series after straight after this, and I'll be doing a 5-hour workshop there where we take little pieces of mushrooms, create a culture, and then we also inoculate a kit, and we just talk about all the stuff you need to know to grow oyster mushrooms and some other varieties at home.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. I've had a go at growing oyster mushrooms. I did that during lockdown. I got one of those boxes in mail, or two or three of those boxes in the mail, and we had like pink ones, white ones, and sort of grey ones. And so that was quite fun during lockdown.
Yeah, they're definitely, oyster mushrooms are definitely the best kind of mushroom to try and grow if you're starting out. They're the easiest to grow, the most prolific, and they grow the fastest.
They were very quick. We were very surprised. Have you guys grown them?
No, but I'm pretty keen to actually start growing a lot of mushrooms, like in our veggie garden as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because I've seen it done, especially over in Europe. So I'm not sure if it can be done here. But there's a lot of questions I need to ask too, because, like, I actually feed the biology. So, like, I feed the mycorrhizal fungi that's already existing in our soils and the bacteria, and how it actually would affect specific sort of varieties that if I put in the vegetable garden. So, but that's, yeah,
well, something lots I need of to questions
yeah, to something answer. I probably need to ask you off here because it's, yeah.
I mean, I don't have the answer to everything. The thing with mushrooms and mycology is we're really only at the precipice of, like, understanding. So I know a lot, and, you know, mycologists know a lot, but there's just so much more to know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of research happening at the moment when it comes to, like, rejuvenating soils through mycelium, because, I mean, for instance, I don't know if anybody knows Paul Stamets, but he was engaged to do an experiment with a whole lot of other scientists, and they had all been given an oil spill to try and clean up in their own different way, and Paul Stamets, one of the scientists or mycologists, he decided to use oyster mushroom mycelium. Mm. And so he put a whole lot of spent oyster mushroom blocks onto this oil spill, and his experiment was the only one that worked to actually clean up that oil spill. Whoa. So
it's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I've even read articles of how they've actually been taking up things like glyphosate as well. So also with the bacteria, they have this synergistic sort of relationship where they'll even take up certain sort of chemical residue.
Yeah, so people are also using oyster mushroom mycelium to help, like, take heavy metals out of the soil. Mm. Apparently, like, if you use oyster mushroom mycelium, you can, you know, inoculate your soil with that, or, like, put that into the soil and then plant sunflowers, and I've heard that the sunflowers actually then can pull out the heavy metals, and you take the sunflower and then you put that in the tip because that's got the heavy metals.
Well, because they actually have deep, see, sunflowers are really also, even just in your general garden bed, because they can have root systems that can actually go deep, and they have the tendency of actually drawing a lot of calcium that's actually in our soils and solubilizing it to more of a plant available form.
Right.
So, like, other plants in and around. So when you grow them and they sort of go to seed, let them die, just cut them off, because the root system is actually releasing those nutrients up high for the other plants to sort of feed on, and the bacteria and the fungi and that to feed on to sort of solubilize for the other plants. But you're right. Like, even with the mushrooms, I think if you have heavy metals or some sort of chemical residue, and you're using that sort of mechanism of trying to sort of absorb it, you cannot eat it because it is in the actual fungus, or it is in the plant as well. So you do need to be mindful of that.
I get overwhelmed when I start thinking about mushrooms and mushroom diversity and just this whole entire kingdom.
Yeah, completely different world.
A completely different world. And it's mind-blowing. You know, just the complexity and the diversity of mushrooms and, well, fungi in the natural world. But we're cultivating just a tiny little fraction of them in terms of diversity and number that we grow to eat.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk us through? I know your book outlines it all, but could you give us an abridged version of how to grow one of the types of mushrooms that's perhaps your favourite?
Oh, how to grow one?
Yeah, what's the process? Just the abridged version, if it's easier than step one, step two.
there's several thousand words.
Yes. A simplified version. Do you want to know from start to finish? Let's give a skeleton version from start to finish. So what you can do, for instance, well, take a little piece of your mushroom, create a culture, which is like a little dish with agar in it. So you just put that little piece of mushroom on that agar dish and then you wait for the mycelium to grow. And then you can take a little piece of that agar dish, which has the mycelium on it, and then put it on some hydrated grain and then you wait for that mycelium to grow. It's tricky because it's like, where's everybody's knowledge at? What's mycelium? Mycelium is kind of like the plant of the mushroom. We don't call it a plant in the mushroom world. We call it mycelium, but that gives you a bit of a vibe for that. In mushroom cultivation, we're just trying to grow mycelium. So we're just feeding the mycelium, trying to build out this mat. Now, mycelium's like a web. It's like a big hyphy web of white mycelium tendrils. And so every step in the growing process, we're just trying to feed that and make it bigger and stronger. So we've created our agar dish, then we'll create our grain spawn. And then once we've got our grain spawn, so our grain's covered in that mycelium hyphae web, we'll break it up and then we can put it onto its next food. And so its next food will be what it fruits from. So depending on the type of mushroom you're growing, you'll choose a different type of food for that mycelium to eat. So for instance, oyster mushrooms really love to grow on straw. They love to grow on hardwood sawdust. So you can then mix your grain spawn into your next food, which is the straw or the sawdust, and then you can fruit it from there. Now, you could fruit it from the grain spawn, but if I have a jar of grain spawn, I could feed it so much more food and get so many more mushrooms off it. You know, it's worth
bulking it up
and doing that. You can even, you know, you'll even see little mushrooms start to grow from, say, a little agar dish, but they're not really going to be mushrooms. They're kind of just going to be little
blips.
Yeah. Because it doesn't have as much food.
Yeah, technical. Yeah, okay.
But it's tricky. So when it comes to growing mushrooms, there's so many different ways of growing them.
Yeah.
So it's like kind of trying to choose which method you're going to roll with. And, yeah, like, for instance, you were just talking about growing in your garden. And so I don't really specialise in growing mushroom varieties that are for growing in your garden, apart from, like, logs. But there are certain types like red wine caps or morels that you can actually inoculate in your garden on pathways and all sorts of stuff like that. So, yeah. And I've even grown oyster mushrooms in my garden by accident because once we're done with our straw, we, like, break it up and put it onto the garden to mulch the garden. And it's like there's so many things in there. So once you're finished growing as many mushrooms as you possibly can from the straw that you've inoculated, you can then use it for the garden. And as we were saying, mycelium is great for the soil profile. It creates air pockets for microbes to live in. It's a natural soil binder. It helps with drainage. Worms love it. Mm. And it also helps plants with their defense systems against pests and diseases. Some plants. So it's a great thing for the garden. So once we're done with growing our mushrooms at the farm, we put it on the garden and, sometimes there might be a few mushrooms that pop up in the garden. However, I do have to say that with a disclaimer because we sell our mulch and people put it on their garden, and I can't guarantee what mushroom pops up, if it's the mushroom that we've cultivated or if it's like a different mushroom that's present within the soil. Right. So you have to really know what you're doing if you harvest those mushrooms.
And that how long does that process take from taking, you know,
Sliver.
Chopping up, yeah, to taking the sliver and putting it in the agar to a fruiting body?
Oh, that's a good question. It really depends on the time of year.
Okay. So they are seasonal, you get that seasonal variation?
Yeah, I mean, so oyster mushrooms, for example, we can grow them all year round in Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
They just grow a lot faster in summer and a lot slower in winter.
Okay.
So
that's the temperature of the medium.
Or the atmosphere.
It's just the temperature of the atmosphere, Okay. I don't know, I've got to try and... Yeah, I mean, like, that might take 3 weeks. Let's say, what about from inoculating your fruiting substrate to having a mushroom?
Yep.
In summer, it could be 2 days. Oh, no, from inoculating. It could be, like, 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Mm. In winter, it might be 6 or 7 weeks.
That's a difference, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that I find fascinating as well, like your book details the complete process, as you said, from cutting a little piece but putting it on agar. But people can also sort of jump the queue a little because you can buy, is it impregnated grain spore or inoculated grain spore?
Inoculated, yeah.
That's the right term. So you can buy impregnated. John's laughing at me. Yeah, so you can buy, like, and obviously things like a mushroom kit. Like,
yeah.
I think the one we bought was, like, in coffee grounds or something. Mm. So, you know, you can sort of, you can join the process a couple of different points along, can't you?
Yeah, yeah. So I would definitely recommend if you're starting out to get a kit first and then, like, just learn how to fruit your mushrooms first and then sort of work your way back through the processes. Like, then you could... you know, start by just inoculating your own fruiting medium, substrate, as we call it in the mushroom growing world. I thought it was really important to give a holistic picture of how to grow your mushrooms from start to finish because, you know, that's always what I wanted when I was learning. I want to know, how does this whole thing work, you know?
So the kit takes you to the stage where there's the mycelium. Is that right?
So a kit, if you were to buy a kit, that's a inoculated, it's a fully colonized block of mycelium. So, and it's usually with the fruiting substrate. It's tricky because I know that people don't understand all the terms. Like when we talk about substrate is whatever we're feeding our mushrooms. Colonization is the act of the mycelium moving over and growing over that substrate. Mm. So just ask if there's any words that we haven't really explained.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you get a kit, it's the fully colonized fruiting medium.
Yep.
And it's just ready to go. So you just wait for those mushrooms to start to poke their heads out and then you start to water them. So you're not actually doing the act of inoculation in that.
Yep.
You're just fruiting them.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good for that that satisfaction if people want that sort of more instant gratification.
Yes.
And like, yes, I did it.
Yeah.
Okay, now I've done that. Now let me go to the next advanced step.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you have just joined in, you are listening to the 3CR Gardening Show. My name is Chloe Thompson. In the studio with me today is Ben Brooker, Buttons Mira and John Arnott. Buttons is new to the station and she is a mushroom expert, hence the discussion all about mycelium and mushrooms and inoculation and all sorts of fun stuff. We'll chat more about mushrooms, perhaps even about eating mushrooms soon, something I love to do. But we will just get on with some community notices first up. Now, Ben, I know you've got a couple to do, but I'll just do these two here first and then I'll get you to line up your next two. So an announcement about the annual Victorian Orchid Spectacular, which is Friday the 28th of August to Sunday the 30th of August, 9 till 4 p.m. Both days, and it's at the Boxhall Pavilion at KCC Park in Skye. Entry is $10, and if you've never been before and if you love orchids, it's dangerous. Even if you don't like orchids, it's dangerous. Your eyeballs will hurt by the end of it. That's all I can say. It's insane.
It's on a huge scale, yeah.
It is. It's insane. Like everywhere you look is orchids in full flower.
And all manner of orchids.
All types.
Cymbidiums, dendrobiums, ground orchids, the whole shoot and match. Yeah.
Yeah. Really, really fascinating. So great one to get along to. Then Saturday, the 5th of September, is a plant sale by the Australian Plant Society Cardinia Group. So it's their native plant sale, including specialist native plant growers and experts. It's 9 till 3 on Saturday, the 5th of September in Berwick. And just head to the apsvic.org.au.
And that's actually
website.
A nice little garden to walk around too.
Really?
Around it was an old quarry. Yeah.
Oh wow!
Yeah, so it is actually quite nice to walk around.
There you go.
Wow, you might be thinking of Wilson Botanic Park. No.
Yeah, that's in Berwick.
Yeah, they've moved the APS.
They're
doing it out of an environmental centre in Officer now, I believe.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, that's a shame.
Does that make sense? Did I completely misread
it?
No,
it says Accoon Park, Berwick, but that didn't mean anything to me. Oh, so that's why I directed people to the website.
Yeah. No, I don't think that
Accoon Park, is it?
Accoon
Park. So that's, Beaconsfield.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
So
maybe head to the website.
Yeah. head to the website.
Well, it's just there anyway.
But for years, they did, the plant sales were at Wilson Botanic Park in Berwick.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's moved to this new site.
And they've transformed it. So they've done a fair bit of work around the old quarry, and it's quite nice. Yeah. So some beautiful trees in there.
Did you have one or two that you wanted to mention, event-wise?
I've got three. So because it's coming out of that season where the expos are starting.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're only maybe 6 weeks, I think, before our first one.
Mm-hmm.
That's at Bollebec. So that's out at Mount Macedon.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually a really big one for us. So we probably end up taking around about pretty close, just over 2,500 plants. So
yikes.
Yeah, awesome. Around about sort of maybe 500-600 varieties.
And what are the dates?
And we have a lot of new ones coming. So that's on the 3rd and the 4th of October.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not too far away. So you put pencil that one in.
Yep.
And then after that, we've actually got the rare plant fair at Gippsland, which is actually at, I think it's 125 Palmer Road in Jindavik, and that's at Broughton Hall. So that's a big 6-acre garden out there. If you haven't been, it's a garden. I think it's a must see. And this event's only just for the day, and that sort of starts between nine. It goes to 9 to 4 p.m. And that's on the 10th of October.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to learn a bit more about sort of doing compost teas and about the soil biology, plant health, we've got Craig Castry, Paul Day from View Gardens,
mm-hmm.
And myself. We're all going to actually get up and we're sort of talking together. We're going to do a Q&A,
oh, cool.
Talk about the biology, soil, how to build better soils, how to sort of create your own sort of fertilizers as well,
yep.
A natural way. Mm. And then also plant nutrition as well, so sure. Which is something I'm very big with.
It's a jam-packed day.
Yeah. And then after that we have Yarra Valley, and that's on the November the 7th and the 8th. And that's, I think, was it 120? Yeah,
Wanden
and 125 Quayle Road.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of, that starts at 10 o'clock and it goes to, no, 9 o'clock now,
mm-hmm.
to 4 o'clock. Yeah, and that goes off for the 2 days. And the same thing, Craig Castry and myself, we're doing a talk on soil biology, plant health as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then we encourage people to basically, ask us questions as well.
Mm.
Craig Castry is on a mission. You see his name absolutely everywhere. He's like moving interstate all over the place.
Yeah.
He's doing talking soil, talking regenerative horticulture, talking urban agriculture.
Yeah, I was in Kalamunda in Perth, and there's Craig.
Yeah.
I was like, what? We're from the opposite side of the country, and here we are.
Yeah.
But it's good because, I mean, that's he embodies it and he sort of lives it, what he's actually, what he's talking about. Mm. And I think to truly have a true understanding of something, you really need to embody it.
Yeah.
You need to really live it.
Yeah.
And then once you actually do those, then you can really sort of really put that point across, sort of, you know, profess it, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And Chloe, so, you've been on the circuit a bit too, haven't you?
I have a little bit lately.
You've been getting around.
I went up to the Queensland Botanical Bazaar on the Gold Coast.
Was that big?
Look, it's a very cute little event. It's not huge.
No.
It takes over quite a large space. And I said to, I was trying to describe it to my husband, I was like, picture a plant fair, like up in like the Dandenongs or somewhere with a bit of a hippie alternative vibe. Yeah. And that's what it felt like. Or it kind of almost felt like you were in Byron Bay.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Nice.
They had three little stages, a whole bunch of us presenting on them.
Lovely.
And then loads of plant stalls, great music, great food. It was really fun. Really cute little event.
Yeah, nice.
Great stalls as well. Yeah, I was very impressed with the variety of stalls.
Excellent.
So, yeah, that's what I've been up to. We're going to get on to chat about, John, the smell that is emanating in this room is a beautiful one.
it's okay.
It's a nice one. Not like when people have bought in the flowers that smell like dead things.
Yeah. Well, looking across at Ben here.
Yeah, I know. You and someone else are guilty of that regularly. But just a little quick refresh for those of you just tuning in. You are listening to the 3CR Gardening Show. In the studio with me today is Ben Brooker, Buttons Mirror, and John Arnott. We only have an hour left of the show, which seems kind of crazy, but we're finishing early because the show that follows us has a special edition they would like to squeeze in. So I think now's the perfect time to invite our listeners to join in. If you would like to talk to us on air, the phone number is 94190155, or you can send us a text message on 0488 809 855. As a bonus, if you call in and talk to us on air, I do have three copies of the ABC Organic Gardener magazine, the early spring issue, to give away. So that's for anyone brave enough to call in.
Freebies! Excellent.
Yes. All right, John, let's talk about these gorgeous plants, plural, that are like making the studio smell incredible.
Well, they're mint bushes.
They are.
And I've been doing a bit of a deep dive into the genus Prostanthera. So Prostanthera is in the same family as things like Wistringia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's some really, really good garden plants. But I've been involved with a project in a regional botanic garden in New South Wales, the Burrendong Arboretum. And they're very much associated. It's almost word association, Burrendong and Prostanthera. So in order to sort of support that project, I've had to look quite deeply at the genus Prostanthera. Over 100 species, over half of those occur in New South Wales. And of those ones that occur in New South Wales, there's about 40 species that occur within an hour's drive of the Burrendong Arboretum, which is halfway between Orange and Dubbo.
Oh.
So it's like this biodiversity hotspot for the genus Prostanthera. So subsequently, that genus and that whole group are really important to that garden. So, yeah, I found myself doing lots and lots of research and lots of thinking about the mint bushes, Prostantheras.
Yeah.
The big rabbit hole.
Yeah. I went down that rabbit hole of Prostanthera. And look, it's a really interesting group of plants. They're mostly sort of shrubby things.
Yeah.
Many of them, not all of them, but the majority of them have got sort of aromatic oils, and that's one of the features, and hence the term mint bush.
Yep.
But they're amazing garden plants.
Mm.
And, you know, of that 100, there's a whole bunch that have actually got some conservation significance.
Oh, okay.
Because they occur in tiny little ecological niches. So a lot of these Prostantheras are inherently rare.
Right.
And I've got a couple of tubes here that I'm borrowing.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, they'll go back to the owners from the Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria Nursery down at Cranbourne. And there's a thing here called Prostanthera galbraithii, and another one, Prostanthera walteri, which are both things with conservation significance, really rare in the wild. Prostanthera galbraithii is known from a couple of populations out Gippsland Way, not too far out of Sale, Dutton Downs and the Holy Plains.
Yep.
And it was named after Jean Galbraith, who was a famous naturalist and conservationist down that part of the world. So, yes, it's an incredibly rare Prostanthera. It's got a really interesting relationship with fire.
Oh, wow.
So it needs fire in order to germinate, but if the fire intervals are too close, it can knock out the population. So one of the threatening processes for this Prostanthera is, altered fire regimes, fires being too often and too hot and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's considered to be an endangered species in the wild, and the gardens are doing some really lovely conservation work on it, establishing a population of these, an ex situ population of these, which is genetically representative, so almost like an insurance population. Mm. So if things went really awry in the wild and it, you know, it became in trouble, there's sort of a backstop.
But it's important to have that genetic sort of diversity too. I think that's really a major part of it, having that diversity in the genetics.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, that's exactly right. Mm. And Prostanthera walteri, it's got, most of these Prostantheras have got purple or pink flowers. Mm-hmm. Prostanthera walteri has got this bluish flower. It's almost luminescent.
Oh, wow.
It is an sort of a greeny blue, really unusual colour. And again, Prostanthera of limited distribution. Occurs in Victoria, just sneaks into New South Wales into a place called Mount Imlay.
Okay.
So quite inherently rare, and both of these species are part of a conservation holdings. Well, that
because we grow that one.
Walteri?
Yeah,
it's beautiful.
So we got that one, not in our range, but we grow it in your garden.
Sort
of in the garden. Yeah. So and we have to propagate it. To keep it going, because it doesn't last for a long time.
They're not long-lived plants.
No.
But horticulturally, they've got a whole heap of merit as well. And I guess the species that you would more commonly find in gardens are Rotundifolia, Ovalifolia, Incisa, maybe Lasianthos. Mm. So they do make great garden plants.
Yeah, I've got one growing as a feature shrub.
As feature shrub, yeah.
Yeah. And when the whole thing's covered in flowers.
It is covered in flowers.
Exactly. It's like electric purple.
Yeah. If you prune them, they actually prune up nice.
Yes, I just clip it with hedge trimmers.
Yeah, that's do it annually. And they do. They prune up really nice. Yeah.
In fact, that's the perfect thing to do. If you leave a Prostanthera go, it'll get big and it'll open up. And, it might be a useful plant for 5 to 8 years. But if you prune it after it's flowered, you're going to get a better plant out of it, a much more ornamental thing, but it'll live a bit longer as well.
I'd love to see a little hedge of it.
Yeah,
that'd be awesome. just a nice border hedge sort of thing with it. I think it'll actually look quite nice.
Yeah.
Somewhere where you can rub your hand across it as you walk past.
Well, they're the sort of plants that you plant on the side of a path.
Yeah.
Because as you're walking through, you're brushing up against it, releasing those oils. And,
and
bang. I mean, the studio is getting a bit heady.
So we'll come out all red eye. Yeah.
And they are obviously all edible, or some of them?
Well, Prostanthera incisa is kind of marketed. Well, there's a cultivar of that which is called Native Thyme.
Okay.
So
that's
they
confusing.
Do have, yeah. So they do sort of have, some culinary uses.
Yeah.
Very strong.
There's some First Nations uses of Prostanthera, more in the sort of medicinal space.
Right.
But some of the documentation is a little bit scant on that. But being such a wide group. They occur in every state of Australia, with this sort of hot spot in central New South Wales.
A range of climatic conditions and, like, you know, sunlight requirements?
Yeah. Look, a lot of them are understory plants, so they're probably best suited in that sort of semi-shade, south-facing, east-facing. They're a great plant because they'll sort of indicate, well, many of them will indicate when they're needing a water because they'll droop.
Yeah.
But they're a bit like that hydrangea thing. They'll droop, and as soon as you give them water, they spring back up. So great garden plants, lots of diversity within the group, probably not as widely cultivated as Westringias.
No, and there is a yellow and a red form, isn't there?
Yeah.
Really fine leaf. So, because I grow the red one, but I find that's very short-lived, so I have to actually propagate that one to keep that one going. So, I think I have seen it in nurseries.
I've got it written down here because it does have a yellow and a red form.
Yeah.
Asphalthoides.
Asphalthoides.
Yeah. That's a mouthful.
And you look, in terms of growing them, consider them mostly as understory plants, semi-shade, east-facing or south-facing. But rewarding plants to grow in the garden.
Yeah.
Because if you look where they come from, I mean, they're that understory.
Yeah.
And that's where they're thriving. So, so sometimes if you put them out in full sun, it's that westerly can really knock them around in summer,
Miriam Ford, the mint bush and Australian plant devotee, is listening in, and she said she'll give us a buzz in a minute or two.
Oh, awesome.
So feel free to give us a call in, Miriam. We'd love to chat with you. There is a question down here. This one I reckon is aimed at you, Buttons. Hi, lovelies, says David. Any advice for growing King Stropharia in the garden? I've tried twice and haven't yet had any success. Do you know that one?
Yeah, so that's what we were talking about before, the red wine cats. Advice to grow them. I mean, it depends what's happening, like on your process.
Yep.
But I'd say if you've just feed it lots of nice, moist wood chips,
yep,
it should grow and keep it hydrated.
There you go. Okay.
But it's a terrestrial one, grows in on the ground. On the ground, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can grow those ones outside. You can grow them. I'd probably try and grow it in a shadier spot, although people do grow it out in sunnier, like on footpaths between veggie gardens and stuff like that. So, yeah, I've had a bit of success with them, like growing them under my nectarine tree.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah.
But fun.
I suppose it would be troubleshooting what's happening.
Yes.
Yeah.
Miriam was there and then she's gone again. Where'd she go, producers?
Oh, she'll come back.
She'll come back. Oh, it wasn't Miriam. I saw the line light up and I thought, wow, that was quick. She's got fast fingers. Miriam said she just tried phoning in. No, that must have been her, but it mustn't have come through correctly. Never mind. There's another message here from Chris. Hi, trying to increase my self-sufficiency at home. What are 5 plants you would recommend to have as given to cement that foundation? Oh, okay. So particularly 5 plants to help improve self-sufficiency at home.
Okay.
Well, to start off with, I think start off with legumes. I mean, go to any of the nurseries, and if they're selling seeds, alfalfa, which is actually lucerne. So as a plant, it's actually quite nice as a plant. And also you can actually eat the new shoots and eat the flowers as well. So the flowers are very high in protein. But at the same time, it's actually helping to sort of break up heavy soils and sort of provide that sort of nitrogen-fixing sort of organism into the soil. So you're getting free nitrogen sort of dispersed throughout the soil to feed other plants as well.
Yeah.
And as it's growing, because I grow it in our vegetable garden just in pockets, and I'm always constantly cut and drop with it as well. But I'm also putting other products in as well.
Sure.
Things like sunflower, I mean, that's another really good one. Like I said, that's another one that'll actually get its roots right down.
Mm.
It's going to bring up a lot of micronutrients as well. So it is actually going to bring up things like calcium, but it will bring up things like molybdenum and magnesium, iron, and bring it up to the surface. And then as it dies off, it's going to release that nutrient into the soil and feed the biology. But at the same time, it's going to help to sort of open up soils as well, because it will actually grow in heavy soils as well.
I'd go a lemon tree.
I was about to say, you have a lemon tree, right?
You'd have to have a lemon or some sort
of
citrus.
Yeah, some sort of citrus.
And if you bite it up with people next door, they could grow a different 5.
Yeah, that's true.
In terms of sustainability. But I think a lemon tree would have to be a staple.
You know, I reckon my one would be leafy greens.
Every
season have some sort of leafy green.
Yep.
I find that that's the thing I try and avoid buying from the shops.
Yep.
And I can pretty much get away with it for 12 months of the year, because there's always a leafy green that you can grow.
Yep. For your green omelettes.
Yeah, et cetera. And even just for, like, if you've got kids and if you're trying to get veggies into them, I find if you chop stuff, mine are older now, so they're pretty good, but if you chop stuff small, you can squeeze them into your curry, your bolognese, any sauce.
Yep.
You can throw them in.
Herbs?
Yeah, definitely herbs. Yeah.
What about a ricotta chili plant, if you like a little bit of spice?
The tree chili.
But I'd say if you're doing a winter crop, broad beans are always good.
Yeah.
And you can always save the seed and put more in. And you can eat the leaves as well.
Yep.
In your salads, they taste really nice and beany.
There you go.
Yeah.
I think you've got more than 5 there. So I hope that was helpful. It looks like Miriam is on the line now. Let's see if we can get you on, Miriam. Are you there?
I am, yes.
Hello.
Hello, Miriam.
Yeah, hi, John.
How are you?
What did you want to talk to us about Prostranthera, Miriam? What are your tips?
Oh, I think I'd follow up on a number of the things that John has mentioned. They are just wonderful garden plants. There's such a variety, a diversity of sizes and colour in them. I know you were talking about Chrysanthemum spelothoides, the one that has the tubular. There are plants with tubular flowers. John's mentioned a few of them, as well as the more bell-shaped ones. And they really are brilliant in the garden, and some are actually quite long lived. John is saying, you know, a lot of them are short lived, and you do need to propagate them. I propagate heaps here, and I also sell them at plant sales, including the one you mentioned at APS Cardinia. Yeah, so I have quite a range of the mints at plant sales, and have had a lot of enthusiasm and thoughts around the Burrendong Arboretum, and it's so marvellous that John is now involved there to help revive the Chrysanthera bed. So we've been involved in chats there.
That's great.
Yeah, I love them, I suppose, because I've become very familiar with them over time.
Yeah,
and I'm in the Australian Plant Society, the Victorian branch, but I'm also the national president of the Australian Society, and we're holding a conference in Alice Springs in a week's time. And we're all about trying to encourage people to grow these plants in their gardens, because it's part of, you know, saving this wonderful flora we have in Australia.
Yeah.
Miriam, the conference next week in Alice Springs, I heard a little whisper that there's 300-odd people going to that.
Oh.
Yes, we've been utterly astounded, because the registration is $1,200. It's expensive to do this stuff in Alice Springs. It's a small town, but it's a remarkable place. Yeah, so we've been astounded at how many people are keen to come. I think it's been partly the promotion of it, because they've had a fair bit of rain there this year, so it's going to be quite wonderful in terms of flowering. Yeah, the conference is called Amazing Arid Australia, and so it's going to celebrate and take us to spots that a lot of the people going probably have never been, including the McDonnell Ranges. We're getting to see Olive Pink Botanic Garden and Desert Park, amongst other things.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah, looking very forward to it. Yeah, very much so.
Terrific, Mary. And just back on the Prostanthera, as you did mention that quite a few of them are long-lived. You know, things like Prostanthera lassianthos, you know, that would live for a long, long time, decades.
It does. And lassianthos, there's like a complex of plants, and you can get smaller forms of lassianthos, like the one that you mentioned in that report for BBGA that's in the locale. Bull Mountain form. Then the one in the Grampians, the Lasianthos subspecies coriaceae, which is, you know, you can keep around maybe two. It's a very compact, robust plant, very floriferous. So there's a variety even within Lasianthos. Then you've got Avellifolia. There's a complex within there. Avellifolias do sustain for some time. I had quite a few growing in Hurstbridge when I was there, and they are, you know, 10 years or more.
Yeah.
They can, there's a substantial range even in the Avellifolia types that are starting to get new species names. They're stunningly beautiful when they're in flower, and they smell great when they're not.
And you've got a whole heap of different species, different varieties, different forms available in some of these upcoming fairs, which is very cool.
Yes, I'm going to be at APS Cardinia, which is in Acoona Park, and they're going to have Philip Johnson there speaking this year.
Okay.
And then I'm at the Eltham, the APS Yarra Yarra, all weekend plant sale the following weekend in September.
Good on you.
Yeah.
Thanks
and
so
much.
And
most of the mints are coming into flower now. A lot of them are coming into flower.
Yes. Yeah. I see them as a spring
season. Anyway,
thank you. Thanks
so
much, Miriam.
Thank you for giving me time. And thank you for your show.
Thanks, Miriam. Bye for now.
Bye.
Oh, there we go. She's definitely passionate, isn't she?
Oh, she sure is, and a wonderful grower.
And she's spoken at my garden club, so she must do some little tours.
About Prostantheras?
Yes, about Prostantheras.
Yeah.
So,
And Miriam mentioned Philip Johnson. There's a tour this morning out of the Dandenong Ranges as a part of a radiothon that Phil is guiding people through the Chelsea Flower Garden.
Oh, wow.
And a shout out to Ben, and I can't recall his second name. Tex Moon was going to join, but he's crook. So Ben from the Dandenong Ranges Botanic Garden has stepped in. So.
Oh, very good.
Enjoy, for those driving out to Dandenong Ranges for the tour, have a great day. Perfect morning for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Ben, let's have a chat about some of the plants that you've brought in, because some of them are so cute with their little flowers.
Well, as I'm in Sydney, I've been watching this babiana open up.
It has,
So it actually was all tied, was all quite tight, the actual flower, And so it's a it's one of the largest flowering out of all the babianas. It's the largest flowering variety, Babiana pygmaea. This sort of comes from the western sort of Cape province in South Africa. So, and it's quite widely distributed, this one. So it's not rare. It's not endangered in any shape or form. And there's quite a few growers that do grow this particular species, specialty growers.
Yep.
But yeah, it's a nice, beautiful lemony sort of like a soft yellow. But the flowers can get up around about nearly sort of 8 to 9 centimetres in width. And the plant will get around about nearly sort of 30 centimetres in height. So it's not a sort of tall growing type of plant. It's usually front of border. And it will sort of die down over the sort of summer period.
Okay.
So that's its mechanism of actually sort of protecting itself from those sort of really harsh, hot conditions. So
a true herbaceous perennial.
Yeah. So actually it goes back down to a nice little corm.
The flowers kind of remind me of frangipanis a little, the way that the petals are sort of whirling and floating and out like that.
And papery.
Yeah,
but normally a lot of the babianas have a lot of markings that sort of resemble the markings that's on a baboon's face.
That's
where they get the name of the baboon flower.
Baboon plant.
Yeah. So,
and it's not quite as elegant, is it?
So I think at the moment we're growing around about, I think it was pretty close to about 15 species that we grow. So we've got quite an array of them.
Okay.
So which we'll have available at the plant fairs this year. So
awesome.
A couple of the, there's a new varieties, but they probably won't be available until next year, but... Yeah, some nice, interesting ones.
Yeah. So, now, the one I do know in your little collection is you've got some Geums, but you said they were species Geums.
Yeah, so we've got a nice little GM, Borrassii.
GM.
Yeah, so this is...
Tomato.
Yeah.
Look, it doesn't matter, as long as you understand, so it's only small growing. So this is the same thing. It's just probably one of the – because there's three sizes you sort of class your GMs at. So you've got your dwarfs, well, your small, mediums, and then your large. And this is one of your small varieties. So it probably gets no bigger than – so it's 20 centimetres in flower.
Okay.
And when it's got the foliage, it's a beautiful sort of tight – sort of like a like a real furry strawberry sort of type of foliage.
Yeah, similar habit.
Same flower and that, but yeah, different sort of sizes and colours with the flowers. This is that nice sort of beautiful sort of bright orange, sort of really pops out once you sort of start seeing it.
Orange, the GMs?
No. So you've got quite an array of colours now. So you can go right into like your lemons.
Beautiful.
There's reds, apricots. Some beautiful colours. Yeah. And even sort of formation. So we do grow a particular one called GM trifolium. And the flower tends to have this sort of nodding sort of type of effect.
Nice.
So it sort of hooks over and it sort of goes into like a bit of a point, but it's not really the flower you want. It's actually the seed head. So when it goes into seed, you have this real sort of real fluffy sort of type of sort of ball of seeds that has these nice sort of markings of sort of pinks and yellows through the sort of hairs that come through it.
How lovely.
Yeah, so it's quite remarkable, some of the varieties. But yeah, so this one's, it's quite easy to grow. So we tend to sort of grow this in probably an aspect where it's morning sun, afternoon shade. They don't really like really hot afternoon winds. They tend to sort of will wither up and you get a lot of burnt leaves and, they don't flower very well. But if you have that nice protection, they'll stay nice and full over the summer period.
Cute.
Mm.
Very nice. We got one more you want to chat about right now?
Primula auriculus. So we always get asked on how to grow Primula auriculus, and everyone says that they grow them in the shade and they keep losing it every year after year. But we don't put ours in the ground. So we always make sure we grow ours in nice terracotta pots or, and so that way we can move them around. So because the trick is in winter and spring, you need to have full sun for them. They love full sun. And then when it comes sort of late spring into summer and into autumn, you need to move them into a shady position. And you need to sort of move around
because
it's the root system. If the humidity gets too hot in around the root system, there's a lot of fungus that's actually in your medium will actually attack them, and you'll get a lot of root rot in them. even bacteria will do the same thing. But yeah, they just don't really like that really hot, harsh conditions because where they actually come from, they come from sort of central Europe. So and they're quite widely distributed, usually high altitudes. So they will need to sort of be kept in that sort of cooler sort of conditions, but need full sun because in the Alps, they are in literally full sun all day, 24/7 sort of thing. So we just need to sort of try and mimic that through the cooler periods and then bring it into the shade. And then when they're flowering, look, they're very highly fragrant. So bring them inside, enjoy the flowers.
Oh, nice.
Because you can get some amazing colours, the flowers, and even in the foliages. As well, so because they actually some of the foliage it looks like they've been dusted with icing sugar, but that's their mechanism of keeping themselves sort of protected from like really harsh cold conditions.
A blanket.
Yeah. That's clever. So, but it's actually quite attractive. So, but yeah, you don't want to be there wiping it off and think it's got a fungal problem, or a problem with the actual plant. So yeah.
Yeah, we've had another question about Prostrantha. I find that such a hard. Botanical name to say, by the way.
Prostanthera.
I feel like there's too many sound effects. what is the best one to grow in a that's long-lasting as a north-facing low hedge?
North-facing low hedge. I think that Prostanthera asphaltoides.
The one that Miriam mentioned. Yeah,
because that's tough.
Yep.
And, you know, reasonably long-lived. Look, I think any of the Prostantheras potentially could be a nice hedge. Prostanthera incisor would make a really nice hedge because you can actually clip that to shapes and forms. I reckon you could even topiary Prostanthera incisor.
I think something for hedging, I mean, just looking at the ones that you've brought in, you've got like super fine needle-like leaves. Yeah. Then you've got big leaves here that almost look like Vietnamese mint. And then you've got the little round, so the ones with the smaller rounder leaves would be better for hedging.
They'd be the ones that would clip up really well. But you could make a hedge out of Prostanthera ovalifolium as well, which would be a little bit taller.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think a lot of them lend themselves to the issue with Prostantheras as a hedge, and the issue with a hedge of a single species is there is only as good as the weakest plant.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of variability in with Prostanthera, so I think a hedge row rather than a hedge would be more appropriate for Prostantheras, although they will clip up.
Yep.
Clip up.
More of a loose collection.
It
depends on the size of the hedge too. I think if you've got something that's around about like half a metre to about a metre, I think you could probably get it to a nice sort of shape. Anything higher or lower, well, probably more lower than height, might be a bit more trickier.
For sure. But a lot of them will clip up.
Yep.
Like you said, you prune yours with your shears.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's fine.
Works a treat.
Yeah, for sure.
Heading back to the fragrance of them, I'm not sure if they would go with mushrooms, buttons. But how do you? What's your favourite way to cook with mushrooms? I mean, I love oyster mushrooms because of the fact that they have almost like a chicken breast texture to them. I've had them in tacos before.
Yeah.
What are your favourite ways to cook with mushrooms?
Well, I do love to make a mushroom ragout.
Ooh, yum.
It's probably like my favourite thing to do.
Okay,
but if you really just want to taste the mushroom for what it is, I always recommend just sautéing it. Mm-hmm. But it's actually better to sauté in a little bit of water.
Ah, do you know who taught me that? Alice Zaslavsky.
Okay.
Wet fry mushroom.
Wet fried mushrooms.
So firstly, start with a splash of water. Sometimes I even put a lid on top and just let the mushrooms sweat a bit, because then you can collect their natural umami flavour and it will coat the mushrooms.
Gotcha.
And then once that water's kind of fried off, then you put a bit of butter in or a bit of oil and make them nice and golden brown. Yep. And so that's the best way to do that. Another way I really love to cook them is to marinate them and roast them until they're nice and golden brown. Roasted mushrooms are just actually delicious.
And that's not something you typically think of doing with mushrooms, is it? Roasting them? No.
I mean, it's a favourite for oyster mushrooms. I mean, I'm kind of spoilt for having oyster mushrooms all the time, so I haven't really tried to roast a Swiss brown, but I'm sure it's still delicious.
Yep.
Yeah.
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 Yum. Now I want mushrooms with eggs.
Yeah, yeah.
Can dial that up, please, somebody. You do have a bunch of recipes in your book, which I think is quite clever as well. You know, you're encouraging people to not only just grow them, but obviously enjoy them as well.
So where do you buy your book from?
So you can buy my book on my website. That's definitely preferable to me.
Which is?
So www.themushroomery.com.au.
Perfect. I'm going to write that one down because I'm interested in buying the book. So.
Otherwise, you can get it at all the other regular places.
From all good booksellers.
Yeah.
Classic one.
Yeah, but I'd say the first half of the book is all about cultivation and the second half is all about how to cook your mushrooms, all my favourite recipes for cooking my mushrooms.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Yum, yum, yum. There was another question that just flew past on the screen, if I can scroll back and find it. Here it is, camellias. Anne's texted in, about 4 weeks ago, I bought 7 volunteer camellias. I waited for the soil to warm up but got sidetracked on a Bali holiday. Lucky thing. Now I'm ready to plant them and I notice they're root bound. Do I chop down the roots before planting or decrease the roots? Please help. Ben's shaking his head.
Yeah, no, just scratch it out. That's all. That's all you need to do. Yeah.
That's what I'd do.
Those camellias have got that sort of fibrous root system. Just get stuck into it.
Yeah, a little tickle.
They don't really like their roots sort of disturbed too much. So try and transplant one and you've got no hope. So that's why I'd sort of just roughly just scratch it.
Yeah.
It'll sort itself out.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's root bound that quickly, it's kind of showing it's rearing to go as well. So, you know, get it in the ground.
Well, things are starting now.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, look.
I think the biggest concern with root-bound stock is that you sort of start to get spiralling and binding of the root system and they never really break out into the soil. They'll continue that they have the memory of sitting in the pot. So you're trying to disrupt that memory to encourage root systems to not continue in the spiral shape but break into the soil.
Yeah, for sure.
That would be the main consideration.
Yeah. And having a nice well-prepped hole as well will really help encourage the roots to abandon that spiralling nature and go, woohoo, it's great.
And for planting holes to be wider than they are deep, sort of wok-shaped holes, I think that makes a big difference.
That's a great description.
A wok-shaped hole. I think that makes a big difference for plant establishment.
Yeah.
You know, particularly if you're in a heavy soil and if you dig very sharp, hard, straight-sided hole, it's effectively another container.
Yep.
Well, have you seen a plant pop out of the ground when it rains? It's because of that reason.
For that reason,
they just do. They just because that fills up with water and just pops out of the ground.
Yeah, it pops out of the ground. Yes, indeed. But yeah, wok shaped, wider than it is deep, and no deeper than what it is high.
Yeah, clever.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. That's really good. Oh, we've got another caller. Welcome, Gina from Belgrave. You are looking for some information about a climber for a timber fence in the sun. You're thinking of Chinese star jasmine.
Yes.
Is there anything else that you particularly like?
Well, something to feature to cover the wooden fence and have nice flowers and evergreen, like always green.
That does sound nice.
I know, I'm asking too much.
Not at all. I think the star jasmines are solid. I mean, they're super tough. They'll produce a green wall, which is kind of highly desirable. A lot of climbers will tend to show their ankles.
Yeah.
You know, they'll grow up and they'll put all the effort into the top growth and not be able to sustain sort of lower growth. And I think the star jasmine's pretty good at holding that.
It is.
It is, yeah.
Foliage to the ground.
Yeah.
Yep.
And hardy too.
It is so, pretty hardy. Yeah. I did find mine quite slow to get going, but yeah, now that it's, yeah, now that it's going, it's fine, but it took a little while to get there. So it probably not the best one if you're like, you want it done 5 minutes after you planted it. The only other thing I could think of was like maybe a pandorea.
Pandoreas are great. Pandorea pandorana in its many forms.
It's got different coloured flowers.
Yeah, yeah. The wonga vine, I think that's called. Yeah, wonga vine. They're a super reliable plant and pretty tough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I can guarantee you possums don't eat that one because they haven't eaten it at my place.
That's a hot tip.
Yeah, exactly.
It's one of those interesting things with climbers. You want them to be vigorous enough to be able to cover a fence in reasonably quick time, but the quicker they grow, the more potentially a problem they are. And so I think something which is, you know, reasonably slow and steady is possibly an advantage.
I think you might be onto something with the star jasmine there. So I hope that was helpful.
Thank you. So would they be, so within a year they could show a bit of a, I could cover some part of the wood, the fence, within a year would they be able to sort of spread away?
They would definitely spread. You'd read the label in terms of how far apart to plant them, but
get the soil ready.
So I'd
tend to probably put in like a bit of manure, just not dig it through. You just want to place it on top, because it will actually work its way through the soil. But then also mulching, it's crucial to actually even put something like a loosen or a pea straw down. And then on top of that, then use something like a hard sort of bush mulch on top of that. And if you can provide some sort of biostimulant also, because that's starting to sort of wake up the biology as well. So things like fulvic acid or humic acid, both really great products. And to buy that, you really need to buy that online. And also another one is molasses. So, but if you're going to buy molasses, go to a grain store and buy molasses. It's much cheaper. You won't probably end up buying a 20-kilo or 20-litre bucket of it, but it's much better because it's not refined. But that's a nice sort of food source for the biology, a carbon source as well, and very high in iron and magnesium as well. So, but that all those things there will actually start to sort of encourage sort of more quality of your soil and biology, which will allow the plant to sort of grow a lot quicker as well and stronger.
And Gina, a tip for climbers is to try and train them when they're young to go horizontal. If the aim is to try and achieve a green wall, a lot of climbers will just throw everything and try and get as tall as they can, as quick as they can. But if you actually get out there every couple of weeks and just sort of train those leaders laterally sideways, you'll actually get a much better result in terms of creating that that green wall.
Hope that's helpful, Gina.
Yeah, it is. Very helpful. Thank you very much for your help.
No worries. Happy gardening.
Thank you.
There we go. Yeah, it is a lovely plant. I absolutely adore the smell of Chinese star.
Oh, jasmine. It's beautiful, isn't it?
It's just, some people hate it, but no, it's actually, it's one of the smells of summer for me.
It's like Buxus sempervirens. Yeah. I love the smell of that. And a lot of people say, oh, it smells like cat's wee. And I was like, no, I smell the honey. You know what I mean? Because I think it's like when someone introduces you the name of that fragrance. That's what sticks with you. And I remember when I first started working in a nursery, and I remember they were saying to me, oh, it smells like, it's got a real strong honey smell, and that's all I could smell.
Yeah.
And then I've had customers come in and say, oh, what's that stink? And I was like, and they said, oh, and I said, what is it? And they say, it smells like cat's wee. And then that's what they're saying, like, it's the Buxus. And I was like, oh, no, it's honestly, it smells like honey.
It's a bit like the ornamental pears when you go past them, and then, yes, well, we won't say what they smell like.
Yeah. No.
If anyone else wants to call in, we still have one copy of the ABC Organic Gardener magazine to give away to someone who's brave enough to call in. Don't forget we have Buttons Mirror here, a mushroom growing expert. So if you've got a mushroom question, that might be a good one to call in. But of course you can call in and reach us on talk to us on air. The phone number is 94190155. Or if you are too shy to talk, then you can send us a text message, which is 0488 809 855. I'm just checking I haven't missed a question. Miriam's texted in the Prostrantha rotundifolia mini pink incisor mauve mantle hybrid as some of the suggestions for Leisha's message.
Beautiful.
About the hedges.
So rotundifolia and incisor
and
forms.
And incisor forms, yeah. Beautiful. They both sound nice, especially the pinky one.
Yeah.
That sounds cute, doesn't it?
Lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Gorgeous. I did have some notes that I wanted to...
I've got a question.
Yeah, yeah, you go.
For buttons. Like, small space, you know, urban, like growing fungi, you could do that at reasonable scale in a small area.
Oh, yeah. I mean, growing mushrooms is really good for people who are like in apartments and stuff. Yeah. I mean, I tend to suggest starting to grow inside. So... in the book, we go through how to grow in plastic buckets, reused buckets, and you can just pop one of those buckets in your laundry or in your bathroom and fruit it in there, as long as it's got some soft sunlight.
So light is an issue? Light, you need light?
So no light? It's kind of like a little bit of a misconception that mushrooms grow in the dark. Mycelium grows in the dark, but mushrooms fruit in the light. Uh-huh. So we don't want direct sunlight, but we want soft sunlight for our mushrooms to grow. Yeah, so laundries and bathrooms are good because you don't usually have temperature control on. Yeah. Like if you've got your air split system going 24/7, it may like dry out your mushrooms.
Sure.
So you know, ultimately we want it somewhere where it's nice and moist, or we create the moisture by just spraying it with a spritzy bottle and watering it that way. So, yeah, it's pretty easy for a small space. You can even try on sort of south-facing, you know, balconies and that sort of thing, as long as they're sort of sheltered. It is. I kind of suggest starting inside just because if you're outside, we can't control, it's not as regular, the like, you know, we might have a dry day or a windy day or all of these things will dry your mushrooms out. So it's a little bit more consistent inside rather than outside.
It's probably also easier to remember to spritz them with water if they're inside, like on your kitchen bench or your bathroom, you know, you brush your teeth, you spritz your mushrooms.
They're pretty low maintenance though. I mean, you technically really only need to water when the mushrooms are actually there. You don't necessarily need to water in between.
Yep.
And like from an oyster mushroom bucket, you could get anywhere from sort of 2 rounds of mushrooms. Yes, they fruit in rounds, to 7 rounds or something like that. So you can get a lot of mushrooms. You've just got to keep sort of pushing and you've got to be patient. A lot of people aren't patient and they think it's over, and it can be between, you know, 2 to 6 weeks between rounds.
Mm-hmm.
So if anyone listening put their mind to it, could they be self-sustaining in a supply of mushrooms?
You could be, yeah, definitely. I mean, there is sort of, you have to just keep inoculating though to keep that going.
So, kind of like succession seeding, like with lettuce or something. Like.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just keep on it, keep the cycles.
Totally. Going. I mean, you can get really experimental. You can start like hydrating more straw or more substrate and like mixing that with your old substrate. The only problem then is, with your old fruiting block, the only problem then is, you know, that mycelium block that you've been fruiting has been, you know, out in the atmosphere for a lot longer, so there's more chance that there's contamination there, so you may want to just start again from the beginning.
Can you collect your own spores? And
yeah, I mean, so creating a culture is collecting your own spores. Definitely can.
And that's
do
in
that
a little petri dish. And hygiene is an issue.
So what we have to think of when we're growing mushrooms is every breath we take in, we breathe in more than 10 spores. You know, we could be breathing in hundreds of spores. Those spores are all in the atmosphere around us, and they're like the weeds of the mushroom growing world. So that's what we're actually we're trying to avoid.
Yeah.
So the first couple of stages in the growing process, we have to be really clean and sterile and make sure everything is cleaned. But once we build up our mycelium hyphae web and it's really strong and it's in that sort of grain spawn stage, it's a lot stronger. So we can get a little bit more loosey-goosey with our techniques.
Okay.
But those sort of initial stages of doing grain spawn and doing our cultures, we need to be really sterile and clean about it.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
What are some of the weird things that have popped up in situations where sterility has been breached?
I mean, lots of molds. Yeah. So, I mean, I know all about all sorts of different molds. Like, I've grown powdery molds, orange molds. The powdery ones are the worst because they just go everywhere and they're very hard to control.
Oh, yeah.
One of the most common molds to grow when growing mushrooms is Trachyderma, which is like a green mold, which is meant to be actually very good for the soil. So, yeah, I mean, but it will start to compete with the mycelium you're trying to grow. So you'll get less mushrooms because there's that like competition for nutrients happening there.
Yeah, Trachyderma is excellent for the soil. And that was my fear, is if I grew mushrooms because I'm feeding that biology, I have that in my soil. It's usually, it's more in around where the mulch is, just underneath the mulch.
Mm.
Am I really going to be feeding that and having that sort of take over whatever mushroom I decide to put in? So,
So you're growing the Trachyderma on purpose for
Soil? Because it has a really strong symbolic relationship between the plant and other bacteria to sort of help fight off against sort of pests and diseases.
Amazing.
So, but also breaks down a lot of nutrients and helps to hold moisture into the soil as well. So there's all other factors as well. But so it's good to know because don't think I'll be planting mushrooms in the veggie garden because I think by the sounds of it, I'll end up feeding.
There'd be other types of mycelium in your soil that are I mean, there's just so many different types of fungi growing underneath, you know, in our soils. Like it's I don't know. I mean, I did have Tama was a mycologist who was working with me for a little while, and she was talking about, you know, we do have a little bit of a problem happening at the moment with oyster mushrooms being a bit invasive because people have started, you know, using, you know, the mulch and different things in their garden there. So, I mean, I would say if you're going to use oyster mushroom or any sort of mushroom mulch in your garden, make sure that you're not too close to, you know, bushland or a native forest or anything.
Yeah, sure. Or you better like oyster mushrooms. So get out there and start picking them, eating them.
I mean, that's the other, you know, thing about fungi and mycelium and in the conservation world, in the orchid world, there is no prospect of being able to grow these things if in the absence of the mycorrhizal fungi.
Totally.
You know, it's an incredible world, the world of the fungi.
Yes, yeah. Well, as you've just said, mycorrhizal fungi is a type of fungi that produces mushrooms, which has a relationship with the tree. In the book, I'm mainly talking about saprophytic mushrooms, which grow on dead and decaying matter.
Yep.
It is beautiful, and you can grow mycorrhizal mushrooms as well.
There's an orchid that doesn't have, there's quite a few, but there's orchids that don't have leaves. They don't photosynthesize. Mm. They're completely saprophytic.
Well, they don't have root systems.
They don't have root systems.
How is this a plant?
But you think about it, it's because bacteria and fungi and plants, there's this, and even us, we all have this symbolic relationship.
Complex chemistry.
Yeah, well, if you have healthy soil and you get a teaspoon of it, there's like 8 billion, or what they call is 10 to the 30, which is a calculation of you doing one and then putting 30 zeros to it.
That's where my mind just starts shutting down.
And that's only one teaspoon of healthy soil.
Bonkers.
It is.
We've got another text message in here. I'm just going to expand it out so we can all see. David texts, love the show. Thanks so much. He has a scion of Stella cherry that he wants to graft onto a young Bing cherry tree. Should I cut a branch down to near the trunk and graft onto that? graft to the trunk or something else? I've never grafted before.
You know who the best person who you're best emailing? He's Craig Castry.
Yeah, he's really good at grafting. Yep.
And his knowledge with fruit trees is actually another, it's like next level as well.
Yeah, it sure is.
I think he's got a grafting book.
He does.
So it was David, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know, jump on Craig's website and send him a message.
Yeah, yeah, he's got a website, he's got an Instagram, any of those ways. He'd love to share his knowledge, David. Yeah. He'd be perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's quite cool.
Bring on more cherries. Oh my gosh, yum.
Yeah, and I think it's always best to talk to the right people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, so that sounds good. I hope that's helpful.
You grow cherries at home, don't you?
I've got one cherry in a pot.
Successfully?
Yeah, it's in a pot. It's successful. Last year, I reckon we... Look, it's only a small tree.
Yeah.
Last year, I reckon we probably got 10 or 15 cherries.
Awesome.
Yeah, but it's getting more and more every year. But, yeah, my parents have a very prolific cherry tree. And that's, for me, that is Christmas time / summer. The bowl full of fresh cherries, sitting on the back lawn, eating them with the pips.
Yeah.
Yeah, ours is raspberries.
It just tastes like summer.
Yeah.
Yum.
And yours is raspberries.
Oh yeah, summertime.
Raspberries.
Christmas, yeah, Christmas time. Yeah. Yeah. We'll fill 20 litre drums. Just I mean, half of it doesn't really
make reach it to the kitchen. No.
Yeah, we out there. We were picking it. We both of us, Kerry and I, we under the bushes, and we're just eating. And then, one, 10 for us, and one for the bowl.
Yeah, it'd be terrible.
So that would be the same. Well, I think if we had cherries.
Yeah, so. I'd be terrible at a pick your own farm. I'd have to whistle or something. We've got a question from Anne in Northcote. There, are you there, Anne?
I am here, thank you.
So
you, Chloe.
That's okay. No worries. You had a question about ants.
Yeah, so Di and I were just talking because we both live in Northcote. We've got a lot of ants in the garden. Now, they're the bitey ones, the ones that crawl up your leg and bite you. So I just wonder with the molasses then, is that going to add to the ant issue for me or what do you think?
No, because you're actually diluting it and it's soaking into the soil. I mean, if there's residues of I think of the molasses sitting on plant or something like that, they'll probably go and collect it and take it back to the nest because it is got that sugar content in it. But it's not really going to you're not going to have these ants that's going to start sort of swarming or anything like that because you have diluted to a form where it's not as strong, it's not as potent. And then once it reaches the soil, it's going to soak into the soil.
Is it like weak tea that the standard weak tea, or is it like a teaspoon of molasses in a watering can? Or?
Well, I'd probably put around about 100 mils to around about maybe, what is it, a watering can, 9 litres.
Mm-hmm. And a bit of warm water so it dissolves a bit better?
Preferably, so because it does take a little bit to, and then whatever's left on the spoon or whatever, you can just put that in your mouth because it's good for you as well. So, yeah, I remember that when I was a kid. But, it's not going to affect... it's not going to create where you're going to have ants coming from, left, right and centre to collect the sugar content.
Yeah, it's not like honeydew sitting on a leaf.
No. And look, if you got it on plants as well, I mean, the plants will actually absorb it. If you do it in the morning and you actually spray pour it over the plant and then into the soil, the plant will absorb it within 20 minutes.
Yeah, okay.
Mm. So it doesn't won't sit for very long on the plant. But in the soil, it'll sort of disperse.
Good tips. Mm. Hope that helps, Anne.
Okay, thank you very much.
No worries.
As always, Ben, great advice.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure.
Thanks, Anne.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good tip there. Another question's come in via text. We've got Marie and she says, good morning team. I've got borage and nasturtiums popping up everywhere in the veggie beds, growing bigger than ever before. Do they deplete the soil or add nutrients? Second part to the question, I divided my raspberries. What's the best way to look after them? Let's go
for
to
a person
the
that produces
question.
Buckets and buckets of raspberries, we'll get to that.
I think the nasturtiums and that, they will deplete the soil. So it's best to do that cut and drop.
Yeah.
Because the nutrient has gone up into the plant. Once you put it back into the ground, as it's dying down, the bacteria that feeds on that decaying tissue and then also the fungi, they're actually solubilizing that nutrient back into another plant available form.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll hang on to it until the plant needs it. Mm. So there's this symbolic relationship as well, because the other plants around will indicate and they'll sort of release like a sticky substance called like a root exudate, and that's what will signal to the bacteria and fungi on what nutrient it needs from those particular bacteria and fungus.
Yep.
So it's always good to sort of do that cut and drop. And cut if you find if it looks messy, then put like a nice mulch on top of it.
Yeah.
So that's what we do at home. When we do the cut and drop, then we put a mulch on top of that. And then we put a food source down also to start stimulating the bacteria and the fungi in our soil to start breaking down things a lot quicker.
In situ compost.
I mean, nasturtiums will get big, but are they annual? Well, they're very short-lived.
They're annual.
My place. Yeah. And the frosts at my place will knock them around.
Yeah.
I can either pull them out and drop them, feed them to the chickens, or I'll just cut them off at ground level, and then they'll still come back again.
Yeah, sure.
If you've got heaps of seed, you can do like a pesto with the seed as well. Yeah.
Oh. So you can pickle them. And capers.
Nasturtium leaves.
Yeah.
No, pickled seeds.
Yeah.
Poor man's capers, they get called.
Hang on, I've not heard of this one. Yeah. That's a good tip.
Google that.
Yeah.
And the question about the raspberries would be, well, I'd either plant them ASAP if you want more raspberries, or pot them up to give them to friends rather than just walking around with bare-rooted raspberries.
Do you need to divide raspberries periodically?
No, you don't. No, it's cutting out that third season old cane. So, because you do need to have that previous season's cane. So, it's usually that third season cane you need to cut out. Usually, you can indicate because you'll have a lot of dieback in it. So, and keep it nice and fresh. And the more you stimulate more new growth, that's what's going to give you that more fruit.
Yeah.
But then you've got to be careful, the roots can run too.
So, am I doing the wrong thing by just cutting all my raspberries down to ground level each year?
Mm-hmm. It depends on what type of, if you've got a summer or an autumn fruiting one. Yeah, so if they fruit on second year wood, then you need to keep the fruit, the canes.
The old canes.
No, not the old canes. You need to keep the canes that didn't fruit.
The first year canes are going to fruit in the second year.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you can often see the difference.
Okay.
So the old canes will look a bit dry and a little bit...
And will they have fruited?
They will have fruited, yes.
So you see the evidence of that?
Yep, you'll see the evidence of that. And they just look a different colour compared to the other ones. Okay. They look dry, they look a bit sad.
Yep.
Whereas the fresh new ones often have a sort of reddish tinge to them. They'll look a lot more plump, a lot more woohoo, rearing to go.
A lot more fibrous hairs on them.
Yeah.
So,
Okay. And so they're the ones that you keep. So that's what I do with my raspberry.
Beauty.
So
you're cutting down every other whatever the mix is.
Yep. Once they've lost their leaves, it's a lot easier to tell what's what.
Okay. Again, good tip.
So, yeah, it can really help to understand. We have had a flurry of phone calls, but I am conscious that we have 9 minutes left. Yeah. So I don't know. Am I brave?
Let's roll the dice to a point.
It is wrong. Let's jump. Let's have a look. Holes in lemons. Christine has called in from Queensland with holes in lemons. Christine, we're going to do a super duper quick chat with you about that. Let's see if I... Oh, is she still there? There she is. All right, Christine, what sort of holes have you got in your lemons?
Oh, I just went to pick them and there's one hole and one lemon. It's on a lots of lemons tree, which is inside a hothouse.
Okay.
Also wondering, are the soils a little bit, it's not really, really damp, but I'm wondering whether I should water it as well, because I tend to overwater them as well. What should I do and what do you think it could be?
The holes in the lemons, do they look like something's been chewing or is it like a shot hole, like a bullet?
Just like a shot hole.
In the fruit.
Yeah, it could be a snail or a slug.
Yeah.
Because they'll get up, especially snails, they'll get up and then they'll start boring into...
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can get out at night time and with a torch and have a bit of a look and see if you've got actually a tree that's covered in slugs or snails.
That's a really good tip. Get out there with a torch and have a look at night time,
Hopefully that helps. Your citrus trees do love a little bit of water because they've got shallow roots, shallow fibrous roots. Too much water and you probably will know it as well.
So the best way to treat that is actually go and buy some smoke water. And spray the plant. So, because, snails hate smoke water.
Oh, there you go.
So you want good smoke water.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Cool. I'm going to leave that with you, Christine, and we'll round up the show if that's all right.
Thank you so much.
No worries. Thanks. Bye. One final question for the team to chat to. A caller had a bag of chook manure that was full of mycelium. And now I've seen this in potting mix happen as well.
Yeah.
Is it safe to use throughout their garden? Yep. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I've always used it.
Yep.
Yeah, I've used it too.
Yep. Yeah.
Are there any cautionary with dry manures, like wearing a face mask? Would that be advisable with, you know, something which is dried out and it's got mycelium all the way through?
Yeah, I'd definitely say so. I mean, even if you get like mycelium mulch and it's got other different types of mold growing, you want to use a mask. You don't want to be inhaling too many spores. I mean, even in our farm, we wear a mask just in case we have a big spore build up in our chambers, because
as a matter of just normal practice, you'll always wear a mask. Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, because we have so many spores in the chambers, you can get mushroom farmer's lung, which is not ideal. You'll get a cough that's consistent, and if you get it more than once, then you can have it for life, apparently. So, wow. I mean, I would say to people who are growing mushrooms inside, you really want to make sure you harvest them before they start to release all their spores, mm-hmm. and you can tell just with the mushroom cap as it starts to turn, you want to get it before the curve of the cap completely turns up, because as soon as it turns up, that's when it starts to dump all its spores.
And I've seen it. It looks like it's dusted the bench with icing sugar.
It can even look like little icicles hanging off the sides of the mushrooms. I mean, if you do have that happen, I'd just open up all the windows, get a whole lot of airflow happening, just try and move those spores out. I mean, you're less likely to have problems if you've just got like one bucket of mushrooms. Yep. If you have respiratory issues, though, like it's probably not ideal. It's just not ideal in general to let them get to that point.
Yeah, sure.
Pick them and eat them, people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're better off harvesting them. Even if there's too many, when they're ready and putting them in the fridge, they're going to last a lot longer in your fridge than they will on the bucket. They'll start to do their natural decomposition if you leave them on the bucket. Yeah.
Good tip.
Yeah, really good tip.
Yeah, that is actually a really good tip. Just eat the mushrooms, people.
Yeah, be patient and just eat them.
So chook manure, which has got mycelium.
Totally fine.
No issue for the garden.
Yeah.
No. But just don't breathe it in.
And just in terms of a mask, you just like a COVID mask? Or are you putting on something?
I suppose so. Or if you've got a proper
respirator,
may as well put that on.
Yeah, just something to keep it out of your lungs. Yeah. Very good tip. I've definitely seen that mycelium appearing in potting mix as well.
Yeah.
Often, you know, if it's the last one at the nursery that you get and it's been sitting there for a while.
Yes. Sometimes full of it.
Yeah.
Which is not a bad thing.
No,
but just don't breathe it in.
Yeah. No, because it's excellent for the soil.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what actually helps to capture the moisture, because they've got fine, they've got that really fine sort of what they call like a hair, like a root system, can get into crevices where there's like the minute type of nutrient or moisture that they can absorb it and actually feed to the actual plant.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of surface area.
Yeah. So.
Mm. Yes. Crazy. Well, we have reached the time. I know we are a little early, folks, but we do need to wrap it up today for the show that follows us to run a special edition of their show. So it's time to give a great big thank you to our producers, Di and Susie, in the booth over there. Thank you, ladies. Thank you to Daniel Jackson and Liam Killick for doing our socials as well. Of course, thank you to our wonderful guests, Ben Brooker, Buttons Mirror and John Arnott. And thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning in to the 3CR Gardening Show. If you are listening to this as a podcast, we would love it if you could give us a rating and review on whatever platform you were listening from. Thank you so much to all of you who joined in with your text message questions and calling in online. Ben's taking pictures. We will put some pictures up on our social media, and do make sure you come and say hi to Ben at any of those festivals, and definitely pick up Button's book and maybe plant some prostrantha as well.
Yeah, plant some mint bushes.
Absolutely.
Or you can come to my workshop on the 26th of September at the farm, and you get a farm tour and it's loads of fun.
Yeah.
Is that on the website?
That's on my website, yeah.
Oh, sounds good. See, all this gardening goodness. We went into a completely different world this time too, didn't we?
We
into fungi.
And it was nice to hear from Miriam too, wasn't it?
It was, yeah, it was. So thank you all so much for joining us, everybody. Have a wonderful Sunday in the garden if you're out there today. And otherwise, we will catch you next time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.